Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Leslie Saul Garvin. It's my great pleasure to introduce Elizabeth Holmes, founder and CEO of Theranos. Here's a quote for you. "What I really want out of life is to discover something new, something mankind didn't know was possible to do." Elizabeth Holmes wrote that in a letter to her father when she was 9 years old. When she was just 19, she left Stanford University's School of Engineering and founded Theranos, a company built around her vision and belief that access to health information is a basic human right. And for more than a decade, Theranos has revolutionized our healthcare system by transforming blood testing and lab diagnostics. Elizabeth's work has been instrumental in passing the first law in our country's history to give individuals the explicit right to directly access laboratory testing. She has more than 80 patents and is listed as a co-inventor on over 100 patent applications. Elizabeth was asked by the White House to serve as a presidential ambassador for global entrepreneurship and is the youngest person to be awarded the Horatio Alger Award. Time magazine recently named her one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Our moderator this evening is Sal Khan, founder and CEO of the Khan Academy. The Khan Academy is a global classroom and learning platform helping over 26 million students in 190 countries learn everything from organic chemistry to computer science to art history. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Elizabeth Holmes and Sal Khan.
This is all very exciting. So, Elizabeth, I guess a good place for us to start is, what does Theranos do?
Our work is about a basic belief that every person has a basic human right, which is access to actionable health information at the time it matters. And that if we can give people access to actionable health information when it matters most, we can shift our healthcare system and healthcare systems around the world to a paradigm in which prevention becomes a reality. And for us, that starts with laboratory information, because lab data drives 80% of clinical decisions. Yet in our world today, by the time we actually get lab information, we're generally already sick. And in fact, if you look the word diagnose up in a dictionary, it'll say to determine the presence of disease from its signs and symptoms, which by definition means you're already sick if you have symptoms of a condition. And if we can shift that to a world in which you're defining or determining the onset of disease in time for therapy to be effective, we will begin to make early detection a reality. So Theranos is about making that access real, and making that access real in the context of changing the cost paradigm for laboratory testing, making pricing transparent, making pricing the same, irrespective of whether you have insurance or not. It's about making the experience wonderful. People don't traditionally walk out of getting a lab test and think, you know, that was awesome. And we want them to, because it's the first step in getting healthy and getting information about your health and your life. And so it's about having a wonderful experience. And it's about being able to do that in a way that is not painful, which means taking as little blood as humanly possible.
And just to make this concrete in its present, and I want to talk more about it later on, but Theranos today, so right now if I wanted to get a cholesterol test, pre-Theranos, my physician, I'd have to go see my physician. My physician would say, oh, yeah, you need a cholesterol test. They would send something to the lab. I'd go to the lab. They would take a vial of blood. And then I'd wait a day or two at best, maybe, to get it back. And how much would that have cost in today's world? Or it already is the case. How much would that cost?
It can cost a lot. I mean, it can cost, depending on where you go, hundreds of dollars.
So $100, that's pre-Theranos world. And now in the current world, actually, not even the future world, what is it? I can go to a Theranos Wellness Center, which could be at a local drugstore, and what happens?
Well, the first thing is you can pay for it out of pocket because the cost is $2.99. So in the scenario that you were talking about, in order to justify getting that test, you have to be symptomatic because the physician will have to write in a code on the lab order form that generally correlates with a symptom. And if you don't have such a code, then you're going to have to pay for it out of pocket. And if you don't have good insurance or your deductibles are really high, you won't get the test. And so the first piece is making it accessible. We've built what we call wellness centers inside of retail locations like retail pharmacies. We have many of ours inside of Walgreens stores that are close to where people live and open really late at night and on weekends and really early in the morning so that you could actually go get a test done without having to leave work during the day, which for a lot of people is hard to do, especially when they're on an hourly pay schedule. And so you can go on a Sunday in the afternoon, and when you come in, we've tried to build an environment that is wonderful. We have designed all our wellness centers after spas with waterfalls and bamboo.
So
and
I could look forward to getting my blood drawn.
That's our goal.
Okay.
Yeah. And once you're in there, we can do many of our tests with very, very small samples of blood that can be taken from a finger, as opposed to with big tubes of blood from the arm. And so that means you could get a finger stick and with a few drops of blood, have your test done. And we've built a back-end infrastructure that allows for those tests to be run very quickly. So you'll get results in as close to real time as possible. And you'll get them through a mobile application that gives you access to your data and a mobile application that comes with terms that say, we will never sell your data, period. We will never advertise on it, period. And in a framework in which you own that information.
Right? And so just to be clear, I mean, there are a few things that you said that frankly were shocking, that these tests that traditionally could cost several hundreds of dollars, you said $2.99.
Yep.
And I think the range is $2.99, maybe if you cost $5, $10, maybe if you are a little bit more than that, but roughly in that $5 to $10 range. So it's a massive, massive price reduction. But it's also the frictions to doing it are dramatically lower. You don't have to get the referral from the doctor, go to the lab, get the big vial of blood. It's literally, I go to a spa, and it's a drop.
Yeah, right.
So I want to talk more in a little bit about all of the implications, because I think when your brain starts thinking about all of the dominoes of, what this means for society. But I want to back up first and talk about you as a person and how you got here, because it's a fascinating story. I mean, first of all, just as a young child, what were you like? What context did you grow up in that kind of started to get you here?
I grew up in a family that was in public service. My father worked in disaster relief. I grew up with pictures and stories of him in the killing fields in Cambodia trying to do work to take care of little kids who had gone through hell. And I thought that was what I was going to do. And I wanted to go into public service. My family lived in Washington. And as I grew up, I began to look at all these people who were in public service who wanted to do good and wanted to make a difference, but they're working in a bureaucracy in which you can't necessarily directly control an outcome. And so even if you have the best intentions in the world, sometimes it's not your decision. And I started to get really interested at a really early age in this concept that building a business could be a vehicle for making a change in the world and for doing good. And in this belief that I think the true legacy of Silicon Valley is to demonstrate that we can build products that will make this world a better place and to do well by doing good. And so I became determined that I was going to start a company.
And how old were you when you started to think this?
Very young. I was, about 10.
10, okay. Yeah. Oh, that's reasonable.
Yeah. Obviously. Yeah.
If you said like 8, then I would have been.
It would have been highly questionable, yes. Yeah.
And so you have this family where you're thinking about, it's literally, your family's literally saving the world. And you're like, what's the biggest leverage point for doing this? You're 10 years old, clearly precocious. You're thinking, I want to start a company. Were you at that point thinking, oh, it's going to be involved in science? Were you intrigued by science? Or did you think you were going to do something different?
I was in love with science. I thought it was the coolest thing. And was in a family that, first, never treated me any differently than my brother. When my brother was getting Lego sets and, you know, science
older
books.
Older or younger brother?
Younger brother. I was getting the same thing. And when I walked in to, you know, tell my parents that I was developing a time machine and had a development schedule for it, they took it really seriously. And you're like, absolutely,
well,
that's fantastic.
Well, I mean, coming from you, I do take it seriously. That is, I'm sure
but I think
some investors out here.
That encouragement is so important, especially at a young age, because you ingrain a belief that there's nothing you can't do and that science is cool, especially when you're in an environment and in a school system where a lot of girls do not think that science and math are cool. And I definitely had that support system, which I'm incredibly grateful for. I think my best friends, period, were books, right?
I mean, were you unaware of like kind of these kind of social stigmas? And where do you think those social stigmas come from? Why, you know, there is, you know, a lot of, there are these biases that, oh, you know, maybe that's for the brother, but not for the sister. Where do you think that comes from, and were you aware of it when you were young?
I think it comes from an incredibly early age. I mean, I was driving by, there's a store actually in Palo Alto, which I hope doesn't exist anymore, where it was, you know, clothes and gifts for little children. And the name of the store was Little Heroes and Princesses, which by definition means that the princesses are not heroes, right? And when you're 2 and, you know, all of a sudden you're being identified with a certain world and a certain set of expectations and a certain way that people think that you're going to be. And I think also when you're coming into a world and you don't have role models who are doing these things. I mean, women who are, you know, building, founding, you know, multi-billion-dollar technology companies and running them. Yeah, at a very young age, people self-identify with, you know, I could be like her. And we need to create more of those role models for people to see at an incredibly early age. I talk a lot about this time that I had the chance to spend with the woman who runs the Girl Scouts, and she was talking about the fact that she got the girls who were valedictorians of their class in a room together and said, raise your hand if you think you're going to be a leader in science and technology business. And she said 0 girls raised their hands. And she said these girls were valedictorians of their class. She was shocked by it, and they spent all this time looking at it, and her conclusion was that they could not self-identify with someone that they knew in those positions, and so they assumed that wasn't, they couldn't see themselves there.
And do you think to a large degree, you're part of the solution in a big way, you know, just not by design, but it's what it's happened. But what else can we do or could we do to kind of change things?
I think we can create the support systems to be incredibly vocal, especially with little girls, about the fact that they can be the best in math and science, and to create a stereotype, right, around that, and to and to be vocal about the fact that, you know, of course it's cool to engage in those things, and that it can be a tool to achieving your dream, whether you want to be the best artist or musician or scientist or engineer in the world. Being the best in math will help you to be the best in those things, right? And to really vocalize it and socialize it, because it's not right now, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so here, and when you were young, 10, 11, were you aware of these stereotypes, or were you kind of like your family was just really good at just not having them and kind of protecting you from them?
I was aware of them, and I went through what I think a lot of girls went through, which was that there was a lot of mean girls in school, and they were mean, so I focused more on my books, and you know that ended
the books
up
were less mean.
Working out. Yeah, yeah, they were.
Yes, yeah. Well, it could have been. And so then you grow up. You're going to be in your teenage years. And when did it dawn on you that I'm going to, you know, it's going to be in kind of healthcare is where, you know, you might not have had a clear image of what it was going to be, but when did you really think, did you see yourself going in this direction?
I spent a lot of time thinking about what was it that I could build that I really believed would make the biggest difference with my life. And when you spend a lot of time thinking about that question, what I resonated with was what it means to go through having to say goodbye too soon to someone you love. Because when you go through that, in my opinion, there's nothing that matters more than being able to change it. And there's nothing you wouldn't do to change it. But the way our healthcare system works, we often find that out when it's too late to do something about it. And so I started to think about, well, what if we could build something that would play a role in changing it, right? How would you do that? And
did you have like an event in your family that was particularly?
Absolutely, multiple times. And I think what's so poignant about it is on the one hand how often unexpected it is. I mean, you find someone who's, you know, had a heart attack and wasn't expecting it, or someone who's diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and yet those things are developing from a physiological perspective for years, if not decades, before they're actually diagnosed in our world. And I couldn't, I still can't think of anything that I could do with my life that would mean more than trying to change that. And so that was why I started this company.
That's incredible. I mean, so, you know, you're clearly a very talented, you know, 10-year-old teenager. You end up at Stanford, and I think, yeah. I mean, I read it was the only place you applied.
Yeah.
What was it, I mean, the weather? What was the...
It was, I think that, you know, this Stanford and Silicon Valley, I think in so many ways are synonymous, and the people who come here from all over the world, they have different backgrounds, but they have so much in common in that they share a dream, and they share a goal to be part of something that makes a difference in the world. And
so even when you're applying to college, you're mm-hmm. like, I want to go to I want to go to Silicon Valley. That's yeah. where I'm going to start this company that I've been thinking about for 8-9 years, and you know I can do it. This is a good launching pad. But and as soon as you show up at Stanford, you start lobbying a department head or a professor in the chemical engineering program to essentially become one of his PhD students.
Well, he's here.
Oh, very exciting.
Tonight,
oh, wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm very lucky. Channing Robertson, who was...
I'm sure he feels, yeah, that you know, he's pretty lucky too.
No. Well, I went to Stanford and I knew I was really interested in these specific fields, and so I went through the whole student handbook and looked for every professor who showed up under the exact combination of disciplines that I was interested in. And there were two, one of which was Channing, and the other was a consulting professor. And so I planted myself in front of his door for weeks, maybe months, until he let me into this program that he was working on to do research in his lab, and he eventually did.
And I want to dig a little deeper there, because, and I think this is, you know, when you go to college, especially a college like Stanford, there's so many smart people. And I think what I'm describing is true of men and women. You know, you're like in this intimidating environment, but you, I mean, you weren't, it felt like you weren't intimidated. You said, hey, I have this thing I need to do. I mean, did you doubt what you were doing? Did you say, hey, why, you know, what is, why would this professor talk to me? I'm just a freshman. What was going through your mind when you were doing that?
No, I never doubted it. it was just, it was what I felt like I was born to do, you know? And so, I mean, I'm you're talking to someone who is an eternal optimist and also a big believer in this concept that you just keep doing something over and over and over again until you're successful, and that, you know, the 10,000, you know, times in which you fail just mean you're going to get it right the 10,000th first time.
And what do you, when you say camping out, I mean, was it like you just come every day for a couple of minutes, knock on his door, or what was the degree of camping?
It was like sit in the hallway when no one's there until he shows up.
Yeah. And you were just like doing your homework or whatever, waiting. And
yeah.
I wish you had a microphone because I'd love to know the other side of this. but seriously, how long did it take for him to give you a chance?
I think it was a few months. We should talk about that.
You were. I really wish you had a microphone. There was a few months that you were just there, and on like, you know, some lonely, you know, day on month three, you didn't say, maybe this isn't going to work out. Maybe I should do what the other kids are doing.
No, I mean, at first I got into one of his classes that freshmen were not supposed to be in, and I could sit in the back, which was sort of the first step. And then from there, eventually I got into the lab, you know, and that was what I wanted to do.
And what was it about this lab in particular? I mean, there's a lot of professors at Stanford, a lot of them doing really cool stuff. What was it that drew you to this lab and you camped out there?
You know, I believe and I've found, and, you know, one of the many reasons I have such respect for your work is that people can teach themselves, right? And they can engage in research or educational programs directly and learn. And the work that has gone on in Channing's labs for decades has been really breakthrough work in, you know, what we call bioengineering or biotechnology or chemical engineering. And I wanted to learn as much of that as I possibly could as fast as possible.
And so it was just this general idea. You wanted to start a company. It was going to be to help save lives.
Yeah.
And you said the best mechanism to do it is in this kind of bioengineering, chemical engineering. You found the professor, and then you get in. You're able to start taking these graduate level classes and also becoming essentially a researcher, a grad student, kind of, as an undergrad. And how did you think about that? Did you have a problem in your mind that you immediately wanted to tackle? Did you think you were going to do, you know, diagnoses, lab testing, or were there other things that you were working on?
I was very interested in this concept of measurement, right, and how you measure analytes, markers, how you can do that at a micro scale, how you can build biosensors and systems that can be used in that context, and the application of technology in that context, which, I mean, this is a field that really has not applied technology for like 8 decades. You know, understanding what is cutting edge in the context of the problems I was interested in solving was the exposure and the training that I wanted to get.
And so you're working in this lab, and it's the summer of your sophomore year. So at that point, how long had you been working in the lab? About a year?
About
a year. And you're working day and night on something, and you decide that I'm going to drop out. Yeah. What made you do that?
You know, I got to the point where I was spending 100% of my time on beginning to build Theranos, and I knew that this is what I wanted to do, and I didn't think that, first of all, I wasn't going to any of my classes, which was problematic, and and Stanford is not cheap, and
no.
My parents had saved all this money to help me go, and so I figured that if I'm not going to the classes anyway, and I know what I need to know to be able to do this, and this is what I'm spending all my time on and what I want to be spending all my time on, then this is what I should be doing.
So at some point in that lab, you started to work on this problem of how do you do diagnostics on blood or find markers for, I mean, how did you end up working on that particular problem? Was this already an area of research? And what made you think, wow, I'm on to something?
Well, I got I guess they called it an award, which was Merck did a grant for students and who had, you know, I don't know, I think we competed for a grant, and I had this idea about a biosensor system, and that won the grant, and so that meant I had, I think, like $3,000 to spend on research, and so that was where I started, and started really thinking through conceptually, well, how would you do this? What could you do? How could you approach this differently? How could you decentralize the access to this information? And once I got far enough along in the context of ideas around that, I filed my first patent, and then
what was the patent for?
It was for a biosensor system.
A biosensor, and it could, okay.
For measuring bodily fluid analytes.
Okay. Okay.
And then when it was time to really start thinking about, okay, how do we prototype this? How do we build it? Then I was spending all my time on that.
And what I find fascinating about your particular story, I mean, a lot of times when people write about you or talk about it, they're like, oh, this, you know, another Silicon Valley kind of classic dropout story. You know, they'll cite Mark Zuckerberg or Steve Jobs or Bill Gates. But what I think is to a large degree extra epic about what you do, you know, in the software world, you see your traction very quickly. You build a prototype, you put it out, they're like, oh, people like this. You know, people are signing up to Facebook. There's something here. Or I made this computer and people want to buy the design from me. Or I wrote this operating system and, wow, IBM's interested in it. So you see that immediately. But you don't see that immediately in biotech.
No.
I mean, biotech, you're talking about long cycles. It's heavily regulated. I don't think I can cite anyone who did the college dropout thing with you know, that little visibility. I mean, what gave you that confidence to say, I'm going to go into this field where, you know, it's not a website that you made. You're thinking about changing how people diagnose and sense things.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. I think part of it in healthcare that's so hard is that the industry itself really, really does not want to change and is so vested in not changing and is filled with people with a very specific mindset that favors no change. So part of it, I think I've always been advantaged by not understanding how difficult the things I was trying to do were, which was great.
Did you think it was going to take you? How long did you think it was going to take you?
I thought it would take maybe 3 years.
Okay. Right? Which even then, from a software point of view, that would be forever, but it's still...
No, we're on year 12, 11.
Yeah. And so you quit. You're working on this. You're working day and night on this.
Yeah.
And literally, you're working kind of stealth mode.
Yeah.
For 10 years.
Yeah.
On this project. So once again, I mean, I this isn't a web startup, social media. This is something very, you know, not that those things aren't also a lot of hard work, but this is a very long life cycle. And what was going on in that process? You were just kind of perfecting. And kind of a correlate, at what point did you say, wow, this is so important, I'm almost afraid that this could change the world?
I mean, it's so hard. And, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears term is so literal that you go through a process of really understanding why you're doing it, right? And, I mean, for me, I became very clear that this was not about me, and it was not even about, you know, if I were fired from my job or, you know, couldn't be, you know, the CEO of the company, I would start this company over again and again and again until I made it successful, because this is really what I want to do with my life. And so then it was about building something that really could be sustainable, and it, that really influences so many decisions, because if an action doesn't make sense in the context of the long term, we won't do it, right?
Yeah.
And that has huge implications on the way we build the company and the way we hire people, how we promote them, you know, our business plan. And so the 10 years, I mean, of stealth, were about creating something that was ready to
really be applied toward making the kind of impact that we want to make. And over the course of that, we built the business, and we were using our technology to serve pharmaceutical companies, and we leveraged that revenue to continue reinvesting in the business. But for us, you know, this access question, the early detection question, it's not enough to have, you know, less blood. It also has to be incredibly inexpensive. And so just because you've, you know, figured out how to do a test with less blood doesn't mean now you're ready to go. And we spent years just on figuring out how do you do this in a way in which people who don't have insurance can afford these tests. And that was a totally different engineering problem. And it was not time to begin serving the consumer infrastructure until all those things were ready, because to solve the problem that we're trying to solve, which is early detection, you can't have a box. You need to have a system, and it needs to be vertically integrated.
And even during that process, I mean, we talked about, you know, you quit your job, you're onto something, you're working on it, but at some point you need resources, you need funding. And did you kind of get your funding from, you know, venture-backed Silicon Valley?
We did. I tried to find people who had built great multi-billion-dollar companies and who really understood what it meant to do that for the long term. So people who were either personally involved in building those companies or deeply involved in the growth of those companies. And you know, in Silicon Valley, so many of these people in the venture capital community are so focused on, you know, I talk about the fact you go into these meetings and the first question is, what's your exit strategy, right? And you're sitting there being like, well, what about my entry strategy, right? I mean, like, and so we have tried to be very careful about who our shareholder base is, because we really want people who want to be part of this and understand what we're building and understand what this means in the context of the long term, and who believe that the greatest value, both for shareholders as well as for the people we serve with our product, is from what we'll do for the long term.
I mean, in those early days, I mean, you quit Stanford when you were 19, and you start working on this. At some point, you need the funding. When did you get the first resources, the first investors? How old were you?
19.
Okay, yeah. So you get it. Yeah. And this was 2002, 2003?
Yeah.
The dot-com bubble had burst. Venture. Was it hard? I mean, I can imagine, you know, and people talk about stereotypes in the Valley. Yeah. It's very male-dominated. On top of that, you know, we're in the midst of the downturn.
Yeah.
And you're not talking about a traditional Silicon Valley play. You're talking about this bold healthcare. Was there a pushback?
Absolutely. I mean, huge pushback.
It wasn't meeting one. They just
No. I mean, it was really hard.
How did you convince them that this was real, that this was actually going to happen?
You know, I looked for people who... my personal belief is that building a company, and the companies that are successful, it's all about the people, right? And if you're going to make an investment decision, what you're really making a decision about is the people, right? And I looked for people who really understood and related to and shared our values in the context of the way that we were approaching this, and who understood what that meant in an operational context. And I was very lucky to eventually find them, but I very much had the mindset that I was going to be told no thousands of times, and that was not a problem, because eventually I would find the people who were right for this. And eventually I did. But I think the number of times that I was told to return to Stanford was very high.
And you never once doubted that.
I mean, it's hard, right? I mean, and you know, I have tried to devote my life to this, and I mean, this has been all I do for a long time. Yeah, so you're so vested in it because it's so intense, and we work really hard in the context of the time that we put into this, But I knew that this was what I was supposed to be doing, so that it would work out. You know?
And so you fast forward 10 years, yeah. and Theranos kind of, you know, it surfaces and people learn about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, what did you think was going to happen, and what was reality compared to what were your expectations?
You know, I didn't have any expectations. We made a decision that we would have a website and begin to talk about this, only because we succeed when person by person we make it possible for people to begin getting access to information before it's too late. And we're living in a country in which people don't even understand that they can get access to this information and they can use it to change outcomes. I mean, most people don't know that type 2 diabetes is reversible and that they can use this data to understand changes in lifestyle and changes in behavior and get rid of these conditions like type 2 diabetes or cardiovascular disease. And so, this surfacing for us is about socializing and consumerizing something that has been sort of a forbidden, scary process that, people get their lab results, they have absolutely no idea what they mean, so they don't use them, they don't integrate them into their lives, even though it's perhaps the most important data that they have in their lives. And moreover, in many states, and we and I have been very involved in this, it's illegal to even get lab results, on a direct access basis. And so for us, the surfacing is about beginning to try to get into the mainstream that people have a right to this data and they should be demanding it and it should be presented in English, not in like medical language, and people can use it and it will change their life. And that's what it's about.
And when you become more open with what y'all are doing, I mean, what was the reaction of industry? I mean, you have several large players, multi-billion dollar laboratory testing organizations. These are the folks that are charging the hundreds of dollars for each test. Yeah. What has been their response?
They don't like us. it's interesting because we live in Silicon Valley and we think, okay, the way you compete is through innovation, right? But that's not the way they compete. And
how do they compete?
They compete by saying bad things, right? And making things up and trying to seed that into the press. And that's fine because person by person, if we create a wonderful experience, I believe ultimately that wins, right? But it is a hard industry to operate in. And I think, so much of what we're trying to do is to open this industry up to individuals, because the minute that consumers engage, it changes the whole market. If you think about like the PC, if it had been in 1980 that personal computers were only sold between government and enterprises and it was illegal for consumers to buy a PC, there would never have been a demand for lower cost PCs. There would never have been a demand for amazing, wonderful products that people could use. And this is one industry where there's no consumer demand for anything because the consumers are just completely disenfranchised. Yeah. And if we can change that and allow the individual to play a role in the market, it's going to change the market, because even just by publishing our prices, all of a sudden people are starting to ask, well, how much does it cost at that place? Because I'm not going to pay more than $299, right? And that's good, because the more they do that, the more the market is going to begin to function. And what can come out of that in terms of innovation will be revolutionary, because individuals will demand it. They'll want a better product, and the best product will win, right?
And one question, why these are billion-dollar organizations? I'm assuming they have R&D teams. They're trying to do new things. Why didn't this happen in these organizations?
I think we're trying to solve a different problem, right? We're not out there saying, we want to go compete with those companies and win. We're saying we want to make early detection and prevention a reality. That's the problem we're trying to solve. What we're competing with is the system that currently exists that makes it such that so many of us have had to say, I wish I'd known sooner, right? And that's what we want to change. Other people have not been trying to solve that problem.
And so you fast forward, I mean, we talked about there's these wellness centers, these spa-like wellness centers.
Yeah.
There's one down the street in Palo Alto at a Walgreens.
Right.
And then you have a bunch, either over 40 or 50 in Arizona.
Yes.
Why Arizona? What happened in Arizona that makes it the...
We wanted to create a model that we could really fine-tune operationally for what we're working to do nationally. And so we didn't want it to be right here, because if it were right here, we could micromanage it, and that would not be representative of what we need to do nationally.
So by design, you wanted to do it kind of hard. You wanted the harder problem to...
Yeah, well, we needed to.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And the population in Arizona is really representative of the country in the context of the Medicaid population, the Medicare population, and a huge part of our work has been showcasing that the market can be a vehicle for realizing savings, meaning we bill Medicare and Medicaid at about 50 to 80% less than they're willing to pay. So if the government rate is $100, we're sending in a bill for 20, right? Which no one's done before.
Yeah.
And when do you
some
do
of your
that,
investors say maybe 40?
We've had the conversation.
Okay.
Yeah. The rates begin to drop. And when the rates drop, all of a sudden you have huge savings that are generated for those programs without cutting, you know, federal programs and without raising taxes. And Arizona has been an amazing model for that. It's also got a governor in an environment that has been incredibly focused on these basic beliefs around the role the individual can play in the market. And I was able to be involved in drafting legislation, which we passed this summer, which has made it the first state in the country to explicitly enfranchise people with the right to order any laboratory test. And that is something that, yeah, absolutely needs to happen, right? And so that's created sort of a framework to showcase this nationally.
Yeah. And how do you see it spreading? Are there other states that you're looking to grow into?
Absolutely. And we're working on that now. We just opened our first wellness center in Pennsylvania, and we're building on what we're doing here in California.
Yeah. And right now, if I were to go to the wellness center down the street, they would do the take the drop or the few drops, and they would shuttle it to a local center that y'all run. But y'all recently got approval that they can do it on site.
Yeah, we got an FDA approval this summer, which is called a CLIA waiver, which effectively allows us to take first of our tests into our wellness centers themselves and place our technology right there in the wellness centers, which is something that'll be really important as we think about this model, because it's all about access, and part of access is the speed of access to information.
So now, you know, I talked to you earlier, you know, as soon as we started to describe what y'all are doing, you know, $2.99, the thing that used to be hundreds of dollars, it's a drop versus a vial, et cetera, you know, dominoes start falling in your head of like, what could this mean? In your mind, and in a very tangible way, when do you think it's going to affect the lives of the average American, us in the audience, or anyone else?
Yeah. We strive to do that every day right now in Arizona. The people that we serve come in with piles of lab requisitions because they haven't been able to afford getting them done before, right? And we have people who come on buses from all over the states. We have people who have flown into the state.
What's the profile of these people? Are they... Why are they getting on a bus to show up at a wellness center?
Because they have not been able to afford it, right? And because they either don't have insurance, or if they have insurance, the deductibles are so high, and people have like $2,500 deductibles or $5,000 deductibles that they can't afford to get their health information. And or they want to get tested for example, a family risk of heart disease, and insurance won't pay for it because it's not deemed necessary, and so they're coming because they want to be able to get that information, right? And there's just, I mean, it's been an amazing process to see that in the context of the human element of, you know, pregnant women who, you know, didn't think they were going to be able to get the test that they needed to know that their baby's okay. And I mean, for me, that has been one of the most humbling experiences of my life, because you look at that and one person's life is better because of something that we're doing. So that's happening now, and we judge our success by those people. Right?
Wow. And where do you, you know, dream a little bit? If we, you know, one thing I found intriguing, a lot of people associate Theranos with its current product. Yeah. You know, take a drop, You get all these diagnostics a lot cheaper than it used to be, and all sorts of ramifications. But I found it interesting when you described it, you kind of said that's the first thing you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you imagine Theranos to be like in 20 years? How's it going to affect our lives or touch our lives?
We want to be the vehicle for real-time access to health information. And we want to be the vehicle for making early detection and prevention realities for as many people as possible in the context of seeing the onset of disease when there's time to do something about it. And that is what our work is all about.
Yeah. Oh, it's incredible. We have a stack of audience questions now, so I will... I don't know if this one's appropriate. Someone told me that this was... I'll read it. Someone says that these were pre-vetted, but this was... on the. Are you seeing anyone? In parentheses, serious. There's literally a phone number here. I'll just give this one to you. You can.
That's hilarious.
All right. This one's a little more. What steps or strategies are being taken to make the blood test applicable and adaptable for optimal performance for people with disabilities? This is from Angela Lee Foreman.
Yeah, you know, one of the first people that we served came into our wellness centers was a quadriplegic and came in asking if they could do a finger stick. And our team in Arizona called us and said, you know, what do we do? And because the man didn't have fingers. And it turned out he had a nub on his elbow, and we talked to our lab team, and they said, okay, you can do the draw. And so they did this, what would have been a finger stick, on this little nub on his arm. And he broke into tears because up until that point, the way that they had to draw blood is through a needle in his neck. And it's so painful and so dehumanizing that it's an incredibly emotional process. So what is interesting about the way that technology can be applied is we certainly didn't design this with that use case in mind, but it becomes possible when you distribute and decentralize and make more accessible the process, and that's something that is really important to us because our mission is every person, right? Period.
Yeah. Incredible. So this is something, I mean, we kind of alluded to it in the conversation as well. Where do you find your confidence? How do you deal with down days?
You know, I trained myself when I first started this to never get too excited about anything and also never to get too upset because I figured if I did that, I would go crazy. and everything is so hard and there's good things that happen all the time and on the same days, horrible things happen. And I've always tried to look at it as, you know, waves in the ocean, and they come and they go, and you're still on the same course, and you're still pursuing the same journey, and you just stay focused, you know, head down, and that's it, right?
And where, you know, on the confidence, I mean, where do you? It's frankly incredible some of the things that we just talked about. I mean, Do you reflect on that? Where this is coming from?
You know, I think for any person, when you really find what you love, right? What you would be doing, as I know you know as well as I do, what you'd be doing if no one was paying you, and what you'd be doing if there was anything in the world that you could do, then you do it because you love it. And so it's not about you. It's not about your confidence. It's about this privilege to do what you love and about this belief that you're doing something that you're born to do. And so then it doesn't matter if you fail or you're wrong because you're doing what you love. And I think that's such a huge part of it because when it is so hard, then you stick with it because you love it. And if you were rational and you didn't love it, then you shouldn't be sticking with it, right? By definition.
Yeah. No, that's okay. How would you imagine that we encourage more future female entrepreneurs and change makers?
You know, I think we need to talk about it. I think we need to talk to little girls about it. It's been amazing for me as I've had the chance to do that a little bit to hear back from their moms. My favorite note email that I've gotten recently was from the mom of a little girl who I had sent something to, and she sent me a picture of her awake at 6 a.m. doing math exercises, and she was like, "I don't know what happened to her." And you know, I think the more that we socialize it, I think that's part of the problem right now, is that it's not socialized and it's not considered normal. I mean, people have these stereotypes about what type of person is good in math and what type of person is not, and you know, little girls right now are not the stereotype, and they should be. And so I think that's a big part of it. I think it's also in the ecosystems and the support systems and the schools and the teachers giving them confidence, right? That absolutely you're going to be excellent at this, and that it's something that is going to help you, and helping to explain how it helps you, you know, whether you're an artist or a musician or an engineer, how it can be applied to be the best in those fields. You know?
Yeah. Were there times when you felt discriminated as a woman in STEM? How did you come to realize that you were discriminated based on your gender and not something else?
You know, I for a very long time have been doing things where there aren't a lot of women in the room, and I've never let myself focus on that, because what matters is my actions. And I think the more of us who focus on our actions and change that through our actions, that's the way that you have to handle it. Because otherwise, you can get really upset about all these things, but what matters is changing it, and we change it through what we do. And that doesn't matter if we're a man or a woman. What matters is what we do. You know?
What kind of resistance are you facing to take your product further and beat the regulating and cartel of healthcare provider and insurance companies? their words, not mine.
Right. I think on the one hand, because we have sort of staked out this belief that individuals have a right to their own health information and they have a right to playing a role in the health system, and we're operating in an industry that is designed to disenfranchise people, I mean, I still don't understand how someone can say that I have a right to buy a weapon and kill myself, but I don't have a right to my own health information because I might do something dangerous with it. I mean, it does not make sense to me. And yet, this is a real conversation with, you know, a lot of people in this industry that, you know, absolutely, you can't give people their own health information. And I don't understand that. So we are working to change it through the individual and through this belief that if you engage individuals in this process, their lives will change and they will change the industry, because the more they engage with it, the more they will demand a different paradigm. And I think price transparency is a huge part of that. It is actually perhaps one of the most revolutionary things that we have done, because what happens as a result is that physicians or insurance companies say to other companies, if you don't match that price, I'm not playing. And that's a great thing, because the market starts to work. And I really believe in the individual. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. This is an interesting question. What is Theranos' vision for diagnostics for mental illness? Is this something that is on your radar at all?
You know, I think it's an amazing area, and it's an area that really needs a lot of work in this space, because you look at something like people taking an antidepressant, and the process right now is take this, see if you feel better, if you don't, take something else, and then take that and see if you feel better, and if you don't, take something else. And there has got to be a better way than that in the context of actually quantifying what's working and what's not working. So we're very, very interested in, you know, in fact, our, you know, our name, Theranos, the integration of therapy and diagnosis, is about, in a quantitative way, being able to determine if something's working, if it's safe, and if you need to change the dose. And so that is something that we have done some things around and are very interested in being able to help facilitate in the context of first therapy, but then also diagnosis. I mean, it's a black box right now in terms of what is known. You know?
This is two questions. Both of them are quite good. When will Theranos products be used in an inpatient setting if they aren't already?
In a patient setting?
Inpatient.
Oh, inpatient setting.
Kind of the formal healthcare system.
Yeah. That is certainly a core aspiration for us. It's a whole different business than what we do right now in serving people in the outpatient setting. But we've had the privilege of forming some wonderful partnerships with leading centers of excellence like Cleveland Clinic and Dignity and Intermountain and others. And it will be a really important part. We don't have a sort of predefined timeline right now for when we're doing that, but it's certainly a focus.
And why isn't that happening like tomorrow? I mean, if I'm, whether it's an insurance company, if I'm an HMO, if I'm Medicare, and I'm looking at these price differences, like why don't they just make it happen tomorrow?
Well, we would like that, as we think about this, and at least the philosophy that I've taken to building this is that our job is to ensure that we provide the highest quality service for every person, person by person. And so we believe we need to stay highly focused to do that in this first business that we're building in the outpatient setting. And once we've done that, and we have a lot more work to do, then we can expand, right? But if we lose focus and we try to do too many things at once, the stakes are way too high, right? And really the stake is you can't compromise on quality here. It's not a website where oops, we didn't QA that thing, it's not going to fly, right? And so...
More serious than YouTube math videos.
I don't know about that, actually. No, I did not mean it in that context, even remotely. As you know, I'm one of your greatest admirers. It's huge in terms of everything that goes into ensuring result by result, and so that means that in our opinion you have to do it right, and you go at whatever pace ensures you do it right.
Yeah. And the second part is it's funny, but it's strangely true. When will Theranos products be made for animals? My cat hates having his blood drawn too.
I agree. It's a good question. We need a good answer to that.
It's not part of your strategic roadmap just yet.
Maybe it should be.
Okay. Let's see. This is someone wants an internship. Let's see. Okay, how important it is to develop a more cross-disciplinary approach to education, and how should we do that?
I think you should answer that question.
I think it's very important.
Yeah.
But no, I don't want to take time from you.
So. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's very important as well.
Yeah. And I mean, to a large degree, you're the poster child for cross-disciplinary. I mean, in Silicon Valley, there's a whole tech aspect of what you're doing, but it's healthcare, it's consumer-focused healthcare. So in a lot of ways, even studying Theranos could be a way of seeing how all of these things fit together.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, just, so much of what's happening in innovation right now is people who have a training in an area like the arts becoming amazing technologists, and you think differently as a result.
Yeah. So this one says, Elizabeth, now do you continue your studies as a leader of Theranos? What skills do you learn and how?
So I try to learn constantly. I should be learning more through Khan Academy.
No,
but
graduated.
We
do have some interesting things.
Yeah.
I'll forward you some links.
I appreciate that. I'm gonna hold you to that. I learn all the time, and I'm learning in the context of being able to surround myself with amazing people. I'm learning in the context of failing and making mistakes. I'm learning in the context of teaching myself, and I've always been a huge believer that you can expose yourself to educational platforms and learn. And I hope I can continue to do that every single day, but for me, certainly, it's been jumping in feet first and learning as I'm paddling.
I mean, what's kind of front of mind for you? What are you trying to get your brain around right now?
You know, we were talking earlier, I really believe that our company is our ultimate product. And how you build an organization that is sustainable, how you build a culture that is sustainable, I'm so inspired by, you know, for example, what HP was in its early days in the context of being this incredible institution that people went to have a career. And I think that's a concept that could really flourish today too in Silicon Valley. And how do you build a place where people are promoted from within and where, I look at the analogy of the military. In the military, you can't hire a general, right? You build generals. And I think there's amazing analogies to that when you think about building a great company, because the culture is so special and it can really be realized and I think can be multi-generational if you can promote people from within like that. And so I am an ardent student of how to do that right now.
Yeah. Let's see what this is. What is the best way to support what you're doing, making medical tests quicker and more affordable? Will your company ever go public?
You know, my wish and my dream in the context of why I'm doing this in my own life is that people, person by person, will start to engage with their own health information. Because of what we do, one person doesn't have to go through what it means to say goodbye too soon, then our work will have meant something in this world. And I think the more people who do get engaged and who do start to take ownership and who do start to demand access to their own information, who do start to question, what do you mean I can't understand what all of these results are in English and you're not going to tell me that and how to use them and how to engage with them, the more we'll change this system. And this is a system that needs to be changed because the stakes are everything when it comes down to what it means with someone you love. And the more people who get engaged like that, by definition, they support what we believe in.
One thing that is a lot of people find fascinating, you are young and very successful, and when people talk about public, people cite your net worth and all of this. How do you process that? What's going on in your mind? Has it changed your life? How do you think about it?
I still live in a house with no furniture. And so
you should buy a little furniture.
Yeah, well, we're thinking about doing that for the office.
Okay.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't change anything in my life, and it's not what, why I'm doing this, and it's not why people's lives are better because of what we do. And if we ever get confused about that, that'll be a really big problem.
If you want to furniture shopping, how do you de-stress? What do you do for fun?
I work. That's what I do. I love what I do. I've not taken a vacation for a very long time, and I think about it a lot now. And I love what I do so much that, it's kind of if you're an artist or an athlete, you don't take a vacation from that. It's just what you are. And I found something that I love, and so that's what I do.
Do you recommend that?
I do. I really do. I think that, I think there's this amazing state that you can be in if you're doing something that you love so much. You're people talk about your personal life and your work life, and they kind of all become the same because you're one person, and that's who you are. And it's a pretty amazing state because you're doing what you love.
Yeah.
Our employees can take vacations.
Yeah.
Like, well,
and that's a hot topic. And this is an interesting question. I know we have. What should college grads be working on?
Oh, gosh. I think you keep on trying everything until you find what you are incredibly passionate about. And I really believe that that you'll know it when you find it, and that it's something that you just really, really love doing. And when you find that, just don't let go of it and keep on it until you see how that can play out within your life.
Yeah. Are there other big problems, big opportunities that you see out there for the future Elizabeth Holmes to tackle?
I mean, there's an infinite number, right? Everything in our world. I think this is one of the things that's so interesting. If you look at just the trajectory of human civilization as humans, you know, you can read a text from, you know, 500 BC, and the basic human principles and the way that we think haven't changed, but technology has in a huge way, and there's infinite opportunities to reimagine how we live and the tools that we use to solve these basic human problems. And I think what's so amazing about entrepreneurship is it's finding that problem that really means something to you. And I mean, we're reimagining it all the time, right? That's what's so amazing about living here is that you're surrounded by people who are reimagining everything constantly, right?
I agree. Well, thank you very much. This was really an inspiring conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for doing it.
Wow. I hope you were inspired by this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Elizabeth Holmes, founder and CEO of Theranos, Sal Khan, founder and CEO of Khan Academy, our wonderful audience here in Santa Clara, and those of you joining us on the radio and web. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 112 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.